Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington, D.C.
I think I saw a response by the Prime Minister's spokesperson suggesting that the Prime Minister was already doing everything he can to end the conflict with an enemy that they term as a terrorist organisation. Clearly, these sorts of calls that the Nobel Committee has just joined have been made already by multiple actors urging the parties to strike a ceasefire and try and resolve their differences through negotiation.
The Nobel Peace Prize Committee calls on Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to stop the ongoing conflict in the Tigray region.
It's a report that focuses in on South Sudan and the need to protect civilians at a time where we're seeing, you know, the highest levels of food insecurity since South Sudan's independence, and also leading into a year that's leading up to hoped for elections, which means likely higher political tensions.
Refugees International calls on the UN Security Council to renew and strengthen the mandate of its mission, UNMISS, in South Sudan.
My reaction is there's an affront on the sensibility of the Nigerian people. It's an insult because it shows the decadence in our polity. It shows the decadence in how leaders take citizens for granted. And it's just a brazen assault on the general sensibility of all Nigerians that we are the untouchables, we can do anything and get away with it.
And in Nigeria, former Lagos State Governor Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu draws criticisms after announcing plans to run for president in next year's general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nobel Peace Prize Committee is calling on Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to stop the ongoing conflict in the country's Tigray region. Mr. Ahmed won the award in 2019 for his role in mending relations between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Political analysts say it is unusual for the Nobel Committee to criticize a winner of the Peace Prize. The call comes after aid groups expressed concern about the worsening humanitarian crisis due to the conflict. They say thousands of civilians have been killed while millions have been driven from their homes. Meanwhile, the UN World Food Programme warns that its food assistance operations in the country's north could soon grind to a halt. This after the fighting has blocked access to fuel and food. For analysis on the latest development in Ethiopia, I reach William Davison, senior Ethiopia analyst from the International Crisis Group.
Significant in the sense it's, I think, the first time the Nobel Committee has spoken up in this way. I'm not sure it's significant in terms of the impact it will have on the ground in Ethiopia. I think I saw a response by the Prime Minister's spokesperson suggesting that the Prime Minister was already doing everything he can to end the conflict with an enemy that they term as a terrorist organization, the TPLF. Clearly, these sorts of calls that the Nobel Committee has just joined have been made already by multiple actors urging the parties to strike a ceasefire and try and resolve their differences through negotiation. And although we've had some positive steps recently, the withdrawal of the Tigray forces, the federal decision not to fully reoccupy or try and reoccupy Tigray, and the release of some political prisoners, we still don't have any direct talks or any formal cessation of hostilities between the parties. So there is still a very long way to go.
Why do you think, despite international call and pressures on the Prime Minister to end the conflict, it appears not to have worked? Why? Why is this so?
Well, it's an Ethiopian civil war. The Ethiopian political actors, the warring parties, failed to resolve their differences peacefully. They entered a war. I think just because external actors tell them to enter negotiations doesn't mean that they then reconsider those choices they've made. I think it's become more difficult to find peaceful resolution to the political differences since the war began, and the bitterness increased, the trust evaporated, the mass killings began, the atrocities. There's also some very hard challenges ahead in terms of the territorial issues, particularly. Tigray's leadership demands the return of Tigray's pre-war borders But Amhara region has occupied Western Tigray and claimed it as its own. A massive political challenge. Tigray now has a large standing army. We don't know how large, but it's big. And that force has been built up because the Tigray leadership and many Tigrayan people believe they face an existential threat, a genocidal campaign by the Eritrean and Ethiopian militaries and the Amhara and other forces. So the Tigrayans are hardly likely to volunteer to disarm or downsize that force that has been built up for their own survival. But of course, on the other side, in Asmara, in Addis Ababa, in Bahedar, in other places, those Tigray forces are seen as an existential threat to them, and indeed are cast as a terrorist force. So these are gigantic political obstacles that overcome in the context of any peace process. So, yeah, International Crisis Group, we've been urging the parties to settle their differences peacefully and not enter conflict before the war. We and many others have repeated those calls since. But the fact of the matter is that war began, and essentially both sides believe that they are, or all sides believe they are, locked in an existential struggle. So I think that's why these simple appeals from external actors for a more peaceful path to be taken have fallen on deaf ears so far.
What are your expectations in the coming weeks about how the conflict is going to go, whether there would be a lull or possible negotiations to end this conflict or try to resolve it?
Things have been very volatile, so you've got to be very careful trying to assess what's going to happen going forward. We have seen something of a lull in the fighting. The Tigray withdrawal meant there was no prospect of those forces capturing Addis Ababa. And indeed, it meant the end of large-scale hostilities, particularly in Amhara region. But we have still seen a continuation of fighting, although it's hard to assess the intensity of it in various sort of border areas of Tigray. Clearly, there is a need for a formal cessation of hostilities and for the parties to enter direct talks. The international actors could play a potentially useful role in facilitating those talks and maybe in monitoring securing any ceasefire that emerges. But there is also, of course, a danger that this is just a temporary lull in the fighting. And given that Tigray is still under a de facto blockade with no federally provided banking, telecommunications and electricity services, no trade to Tigray, and very little aid going in fact, no aid since December the 14th, and no fuel, vital for humanitarian operations since August, then the Tigray leadership is not just going to sit there whilst they remain under what they describe as a siege.
William Davison is senior Ethiopia analyst from the International Crisis Group. He spoke with me from London. In Uganda, the leader of the main opposition party, the National Unity Platform, or NUP, is calling on supporters to wear the red beret, a symbol of resistance for the group. Popular parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, says wearing beret will not break any of the country's laws. But analysts say his call will sharply increase tension with the authorities, especially when civilians are prohibited from wearing military fatigues. The red beret is worn by personnel from the military police. Wine's call came after Andrew Mwenda, a prominent journalist who supports the government, was captured on video wearing a military uniform and speaking on board a military helicopter in support of the army's offensive against rebels in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. They are calling on the authorities to prosecute the journalist for breaking the law, like other civilians who are languishing in jail for violating the prohibition. For the latest development, I reach political analyst Yusuf Serenkuma.
The law in Uganda, I'm not sure which law it is, because, you know, we keep coming up with these laws, which bars civilians from wearing anything that is meant for the security forces. A week ago, you know, Uganda's most celebrity journalist, who also is friends with the government, was videotaped speaking inside a military chopper in proper military fatigue. There's so many people who are in jail for wearing military fatigues. Actually, not military fatigues, but things that look like military fatigues, right? Among other things, the Red Beret. But here is a journalist who is friends with the government doing the same and no consequence, right? In fact, the leader of the Land Forces, which is the biggest wing of the Uganda Police Defense Forces, who is also the son of the president, General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, tweeted in support of Andrew Mwenda wearing military fatigues, even if he's a civilian, right? He said, Andrew Mwenda loves the Uganda People's Defense Forces, and so because of his love, he wants to be like us, you know, and there's no problem with...
You see, some people are suggesting that Bobi Wine's call could test the resolve of the impartiality or how the law is applied in Uganda. What's your analysis on that?
I want to understand his call differently, right? In fact, his call is actually saying we need to have equal application of the law. If the law bars every single civilian from wearing anything that is gazetted for the military, even Andrew Mwenda should be in jail right now. Andrew Mwenda should be tried in the military court-martial. He should be tried and sentenced to 7 years in prison for wearing military fatigues. Right, so the call that Bobi Wine is making is calling on the security establishment, is calling the judiciary, is calling for fairness. There should be equal application of the law for cases such as, you know, breaking or camouflaging and trying to look like a member of the military forces when you're not. So that's how I understand his call. There's another angle I want to bring to Bobi Wine calling on civilians to return to the Red Beret, right? The Red Beret emerged as a symbol of protest. It is part of your regional people power.
I understand he's calling for fairness, you know, in the application of the law, but is it realistic looking at the prevailing conditions in Uganda?
Okay, that's interesting you ask that. You know, if you ask in my honest opinion, it doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make sense at all. Disorder, double standards, unfairness is the way we're governed, right? It doesn't make sense at all that he's called. Nobody's going to wear the Red Beret because Bobi Wine called on them to do so. Nobody's going to do that. You know, if you call for fairness in application of the law, you know, you are at the extreme end of this journey, right? You know, we have so many things which are dysfunctional, which are applied in a strange way, where the double standards are so ridiculous that, you know, the Red Beret is a really small thing in the major play of things, you know. So if you ask for whether he's being realistic, I would say he's trying to be political. He's trying to play politics that he should add his voice onto this.
Some people are suggesting that this call is dangerous because in spite of him looking at it politically and, you know, trying to ensure fairness about the application of the law, the enforcement of the law by the security agencies, including the police, this will put his supporters in danger because the police will certainly, or the security agencies will certainly crack down on this.
Bobi Wine's supporters in danger, whether they wear the Red Beret or not. But you gotta appreciate that I don't see people wearing the Red Beret because Bobi Wine called on them to do so. I don't see that. Bobi Wine can't even call on his MPs to wear the Red Beret, lest his supporters. Many young men are in jail, and they've done nothing to get them out of jail. Two of his MPs are in jail. They've done nothing to do that, to get them out of jail. So if MPs are in jail and you can't get them out of prison, nobody is going to risk their lives because wearing the Red Beret because the principal of NUP called on them to do that.
Yusuf Serenkuma is a Ugandan political analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Refugees International is calling on the UN Security Council to renew and strengthen the mandate of its mission, UNMISS, in South Sudan. The group says the mandate should continue to provide civilian protection to the victims displaced by conflict. In its latest report, Refugees International details Action South Sudan donor partners, the UN Security Council and UNMISS, the US, and the US can take to help resolve the ongoing humanitarian crisis and ensure the full implementation of the 2018 peace agreement between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar. The report follows concerns that the humanitarian crisis is getting worse. Experts warn that the peace agreement appears to be faltering, while the attention of the East African countries' international donors and diplomats seem to be waning. Aid groups say the conflict has displaced about 4 million people. To learn more recommendations to help address the crisis in South Sudan, I reached the author of the report, Daniel Sullivan. He is also Refugee International's Deputy Director for Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, and is also an expert on the humanitarian and displacement crisis in South Sudan.
It's a report that focuses in on South Sudan and the need to protect civilians and continue focus on protecting civilians at a time where we're seeing, you know, the highest levels of food insecurity since South Sudan's independence, and also leading into a year that's leading up to hoped for elections, which means likely higher political tensions, and also at a time where much of the world and the region's attention is elsewhere, for lots of good reasons, with Ethiopia and Sudan both experiencing a coup and bloody massacres and turmoil. But it's a reminder that South Sudan's still there and facing increasing challenges, particularly from a humanitarian and displacement point of view, where a third of the country remains displaced. And we're looking at the UN peacekeeping mission is set to have its mandate renewed, and it's a time to really emphasize the need for further resources and maintaining a focus on the need to protect civilians, particularly vulnerable, displaced people, even as there's increasing political tension and need for attention on implementing the peace agreement.
Dan, some people have expressed concern and have called on the UN Security Council to renew its mission, to bolster its mandate. Some people are saying UNMISS has not been effective. So do you think the call for its mandate to be strengthened is the right call?
Yes, I do. But it much more than just the mandate, because there's a lot of good things in the mandate calling on UNMISS to do a lot of different things, you know, two of the main things being to help implement the peace, and secondly, to protect civilians. I think the issue is matching those demands with the resources and the diplomatic backing that will allow UNMISS to do that. You know, so they need more, you see, for example, in the United States, where even though the United States is the leading humanitarian donor to South Sudan, it hasn't had the same heft in terms of diplomatic engagement, at least not recently. There hasn't been a U.S. ambassador to South Sudan appointed in a year and a half, and a special envoy position hasn't been filled since last August. So there's a need to do more with what's in the mandate already, a need to not forget the people who have been displaced and that protection of civilian side of things, even when there's more of a move towards engage the elites on implementing peace.
Talking about the U.S. involvement, the report called on the U.S. to do more, working with the U.N. Security Council or its mission in South Sudan or UNMISS, to do more in order to protect civilians and internally displaced people. What more do you think the U.S. government can do in this directive?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, again, the need for more robust diplomatic engagement, working through the troika, right, of the U.S., the U.K. and Norway that has traditionally played a leading role, engaging with the regional guarantors of the peace. You know, understandably, there are added challenges with the regional group of IGAD, where you have Sudan has experienced a coup and was a big part of pushing the South Sudanese agreement. So it's maintaining diplomatic attention and resources, as well as the humanitarian resources, where the needs have gone up, but the international donations have not gone up in the same way.
There are also concerns that the attention of donors and diplomats appears to be waning in South Sudan. But some people are saying, well, you can't blame the donors, especially when the leaders are unwilling to ensure there is peace. They signed multiple peace agreements that appear not to have resolved the conflict in the country. What are your thoughts?
I think that's absolutely right, that it's, you know, the welfare and well-being of the people starts with the elites who are making these peace agreements, with sticking to those, and with attacking and tackling the corruption, high levels of corruption in the country. The trade-off, though, shouldn't be that there is no humanitarian aid. It's just doing that humanitarian and development aid in a smarter way that ensures that it's not being manipulated. I mean, one of the big dangers is that if you are bringing resources to a certain area, it, you know, there's been a lot of movements of populations and different ethnic groups having to flee an area and other ethnic groups coming in. So there's a real danger that any kind of new resources coming in can just will cement those the results of this, in some case, you know, this ethnic dislocation, and in some cases ethnic cleansing.
Daniel Sullivan is Refugee International's Deputy Director for Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Nigeria, One Love Foundation, a human rights NGO, says the Nigerian government Twitter ban violated the constitution by abusing the right of citizens to free speech. The group says it will continue with its court action against the administration in Abuja following its seven-month Twitter ban. The government banned the social media platform after it deleted a message about a secessionist movement by President Muhammadu Buhari. Twitter said the posting violated its policy against threatening material. But the civil society group filed a suit with the ECOWAS court to nullify the ban. Analysts say government in the region routinely refused to implement judgments from the regional court. It is unclear how the human rights group will enforce the ruling if it wins the case. Samuel Ihiansi Kien Jr. is the lead lawyer for the One Love Foundation. He tells me that the government ban violates constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech.
The ban on Twitter is not just unconstitutional. It is an infringement of the rights of every Nigerian who actually uses Twitter. There is no legal justification for the banning of Twitter. There is no legal framework. There's no legal finality, and right before this time, and with our press release as a foundation which I represent, One Love Foundation, we have actually approached the ECOWAS court alongside some other civil society like TERAP and others. And judgment on Twitter ban by the Nigerian federal government has been adjourned to the 20th of January 2022 of this month, and we're actually waiting for the judgment so that the whole world can actually see the position of the court as regards the Twitter ban. We are hopeful and very, very have faith in that judgment. Whether they have lifted it is of no consequence. It's not, it doesn't make our suit academic. The ban itself was illegal, and we hope the ECOWAS court will do justice to it. Taking into cognizance that it's not something to celebrate, in the guise that Twitter, usage of Twitter, borders on the expression of fundamental human rights of the Nigerian people. So a shutdown of it has actually breached every Nigerian's right for the past 5 to 6 months.
Governments in Africa routinely do not implement rulings by the ECOWAS court. So what significance does this make? Because the Twitter ban has been lifted anyway, some people argue. What do you say to that?
Yes, the federal government will comply with this present ECOWAS court judgment that borders on Twitter ban. Nigeria is one of the related parties by the AGF who are actually the contracting parties to the ECOWAS treaty. And Nigeria is also a signatory to the ECOWAS treaty. And the AGF is mandated by the ECOWAS protocol to implement every judgment of the ECOWAS court. But most importantly, under the Nigerian law, there's what we call this, the SOGA, Foreign Enforcement Judgment Repository Act. My intention before this time, as a group, acting on behalf of my group, was to register the judgment of the court, of the ECOWAS court, as a judgment of our local court here, and take other steps to enforce this judgment. But thank God a little reason came to the Nigerian government. They've been able to save themselves from that stress. And but still, I will get the judgment and still register it as a judgment of our local court. And subsequently, if there are monetary damages that have been awarded to Nigerians and the foundation in which I represent, I will make sure that the judgment is enforced to the latter, including even garnishing Nigerian federal government's account that is in the credit of the CBN. I'm not going to stop at that, to serve as a consequence that next time they cannot arbitrarily just go ahead and begin to breach the rights of Nigerians in this community.
But you know, the government has raised issues of sovereignty and that it has the mandate to protect life and property, and that Twitter was being used at the time to create confusion, create instability, and the government had to act.
That is merely an afterthought and is not justified in circumstances. They banned Twitter and they raised those issues. Those issues were never raised. These issues, I want to ask the federal government of Nigeria. We have an Adamu Gaba who operates a local app called Kuri. How many times have Adamu Gaba paid tax that relates to his usage of that social media handle called Kuri? How many times? Subsequently, again, other social media sites that are friendly, very friendly to this administration, like Ko. Where is Ko's office in Nigeria? Ko, which tax has Ko paid in Nigeria? Can they show Nigerians their tax returns? More importantly, Twitter operates in the airspace. If the issue before the ban was that Twitter was not paying tax and they need to operate as a business concern, we don't have a problem with that. It's the right of every responsible organization and company and every individual to pay tax to the constituent government. But not in these instances. The reason for them banning was that some certain reasons that cannot be justified in the circumstances. Me and others, we know the peculiar circumstances that led to this Twitter ban. We know the peculiar circumstances that led to this Twitter ban. So the issue of whether Twitter cannot be a form of actually undermining Nigeria's sovereignty. So if that was the reason, then I don't see why Twitter ban would have ever been suspended for something that for a social media microblogging site they have accused that undermines Nigerian security. Then why are they recalling Twitter back to the Nigeria airspace?
Samuel Ihenze Ken Jr. is the lead lawyer for the One Love Foundation. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Meanwhile, the political pressure group Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law says it will revive a court case against Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, a former Lagos State governor and a prominent member of the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC. This after Mr. Tinubu announced plans to run for the presidency in the next general election scheduled for 2023. The former governor made his announcement following a meeting with President Muhammadu Buhari at the presidential palace in the capital, Abuja. He is credited with playing a key role in the formation of the APC and the party's success in the recent elections. But Concern Nigeria says the former Lagos State governor should be barred from running. The group cited an interview where Tinubu claimed ownership of monies contained in 2 bullion vans at his residence, a violation, the group says, of Nigeria's financial policy. The policy prohibits individuals from handling cash of more than 5 million naira or $12,069. But supporters of the former governor say members of the political pressure group are haters who are staging a publicity stunt to stay relevant. They say Tinubu has not violated any laws. Deji Adeyanju is the convener for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He tells me that Tinubu should not be allowed to become the next Nigerian president.
My reaction is there's an affront on the sensibility of the Nigerian people. It's an insult because it shows the decadence in our polity. It shows the decadence in how leaders take citizens for granted. And it's just a brazen assault on the general sensibility of all Nigerians that we are the untouchables, we can do anything and get away with it.
But then some people are saying he's a Nigerian. He proved an effective leader and a governor in Lagos State by running the state effectively, he is entitled to run as a president. And if it's his lifelong ambition to do so, why not?
Armed robbers, non-Nigerians, kidnappers, non-Nigerians, terrorists, non-Nigerians, people who have been convicted for corruption, non-Nigerians. The Money Laundering Prohibition Act says no Nigerian shall be, that is a citizen, shall be in custody of more than 5 million naira cash. And no corporate organization that are referenced by companies and other matters, a corporate organization means a corporate personality, a corporate body, a body corporate in law, shall be in possession of more than 10 million naira. So a company cannot be in possession of 10 million naira in line with Section 1 of the Money Laundering Prohibition Act. Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu was seen in his on the eve of the 2019 election with $2 billion. He's not a commercial bank, for God's sake. We are saying such a person should run for president. He owns private jets. He all kinds of properties and houses in Lagos and in this country. And you are telling me, and he has no any other known source of income or revenue. And the owners on him, once you have been found for being in custody of $2 billion, the offense is strict liability. You don't need burden of proof. The proof now, the owners now sits on him to explain where did he get money to be in possession of bullion bars. What is his trade? What is his profession? He did not invent a mobile app. He's not a he did not invent any scientific discovery. He does not have any other business aside politics.
Well, some people are saying that his critics have been emboldened, including your organization, just to score cheap political points, and that he has legitimate investment. Everybody knows in Lagos that he has invested
heavily. Where is the investment? Where is the investment? Where did he get the money from? What is his source of income? This is somebody who $2 billion drove into his house. He came on national TV to say the money is his. Where did he get the money? What is his source of income, for God's sake? He shouldn't be running for president.
Some people are saying that presidential candidates in Nigeria, you typically do not declare their assets. So why should Bola and Ahmed Tinubu, affectionately called by his supporters as the Jagaban, do the undoable, they argue? How do you respond to that?
You shouldn't be running for president. That is what I'm insisting on. No Nigerian since creation of this country has ever been caught a politician with $2 billion in his house. It has never happened before. He's the first. Such a man should not go anywhere close to the seat of power. So you want to tell me that such a man should not be the one to determine who becomes the SEC chairman, MD of NMPC, Central Bank governor, that man?
People are saying if there's proof that he has committed any crime, if there's proof that he has stolen any public funds, people should provide it. These are just mere allegations just to tarnish his reputation.
It's not allegation, my brother.
Efforts of becoming the next president of Nigeria.
This man went to Osun State during when they were doing re-election, and he opened his own mouth. Nobody compelled him and said, "I'm richer than Osun State." He said it. The video is there on the internet. What is his profession that he'll be richer than Osun State, for God's sake? What is his profession? Nobody's asking him. Who forced him to drive bullion bars into his house? That's a strict liability offense. He should not be working freely, not to talk more of daring to contest for president. Yes, he should have arrested him the next day. In Senate crimes, he will have been arrested almost the next day. FBI will have picked him up in America. Nobody does that and gets away with it. He now wants to come and say he wants to be president of a nation like ours. It's not possible. You should not, things like this should not be condoned, because younger ones are watching, they are taking notes, and the younger ones are going to come and destroy this country and commit more grievous crimes than the kind of crimes Asiwaju has committed in this country.
Well, Deji, yes. Some people are saying these are mere allegations, and that if Nigerian youth decide to vote for him to become the next president, then why not?
Who is alleging him of taking bullion bars into his house? Did he not take bullion bars to his house? Who is alleging him? Did he not open his own mouth and say it's richer than Osun State? What is his source of income? How did he make that kind of money? How? The man has indicted himself.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener for the protection of human rights and rule of law. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Business. Business Unity South Africa, or BUSA, the principal representative of businesses in the country, says it backs the full implementation of the recommendations contained in the Zondo Commission's report. The report was the result of a Judicial Commission inquiry into allegations of corruption or state capture. The document says some members of the ruling African National Congress benefited from acts of fraud. BUSA says all sectors of society must consider backing the recommendations. The group also calls for the investigation and prosecution of those named in the report. The remarks follow a special meeting of the BUSA board to consider the group's response to the Zondo Commission's findings. Meanwhile, President Cyril Ramaphosa says his administration will implement the recommendations of the committee, but critics say the president has not outlined how his government will administer them. Cass Kuvordia is the CEO of BUSA. He tells me that his group is prepared to provide resources, including private prosecutors and other relevant assistance, to the National Prosecuting Authority to investigate organizations or individuals named in the Zondo Commission's report.
We made the point that the report is an inflection point in South Africa, and that it is a detailed report. It makes specific recommendations. It identifies government departments, state-owned enterprises, businesses, other than civil society that it considers were complicit in state capture. It makes recommendations to the National Prosecuting Authority to investigate and prosecute particular people and particular institutions. And we believe, certainly as business, that we will take this report very seriously. We believe that the report actually gives us the responsibility to have some serious introspection in business, because we cannot point fingers at any other constituency if we don't look at our own house first. And what we've agreed is that, so you understand that BUSA is a confederal structure, right? So we, corporates are not our members. The business organizations are our members. And we've ask those business organizations that have members that are mentioned in the report. We've asked them to individually meet with those members.
A lot of South Africans, I understand, have been urging the criminal justice system to allocate funds or resources for expedited investigation and prosecution of those mentioned in the report. What is the stance of BUSA on that?
So one of our members has already started talking to the National Prosecuting Authority to see if they can provide some sort of resource and capacity to the authority. That member briefed the BUSA board on Monday, and the BUSA board decided that we will sit down with that member and whoever they've been involved with. We will try to look at expanding that discussion with the National Prosecuting Authority into BUSA so that all our members can be called upon to actually assist. So in the next 2 weeks or so, we're hoping to meet with a public prosecutor. We will take guidance from her. So we need to do this very carefully. We don't want to create more problems in trying to solve the problem, but we've committed to put into place a mechanism to assist. We will meet with the National Public Prosecutor and we will see how we can do that.
President Cyril Ramaphosa is on record to have said that the recommendations contained in the report will be fully implemented. But critics say he did not specify how that will be done. What's the stance of BUSA on that?
BUSA, again, we publicly said that we agree with and accept all the recommendations made by the Zondo Commission, where they actually say, so in the formation of anti-corruption organization, they say that government must, in consultation with the private sector, put this into place. So where the private sector is mentioned as a party, we agree that the government must implement these recommendations as a matter of extreme urgency and must do it in a way that they report to the public on how they're doing it and what the progress is. Because this is, as I said, a seminal report. It's an inflection point in our country. And we've got to implement those recommendations. And government has got to take the lead in that. And again, we are happy to work with government and other social partners to play our role in ensuring that those recommendations are implemented urgently.
What has been the reaction of South Africans as well as members of your group, particularly when names were mentioned that some leading members of the ruling party benefited from corrupt practices or graft?
We're quite clear. The National Prosecuting Authority must investigate them. If they find that there's a prima facie case that they have been complicit in state capture, she must build a case, she must take that to court, and she must prosecute. And as critical as that. It doesn't matter whether it's a corporate, it doesn't matter whether it's a senior member of government, it doesn't matter if it's a CEO of a state-owned enterprise, whoever is mentioned, and whichever institution is mentioned, must be investigated. If there's a prima facie case, a solid case must be put together, and they must be prosecuted, and hopefully they must end up in jail. So we're quite clear about that.
Kaas Kovadia is the CEO of Business Unity South Africa, or BUSA. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, supporters of Mali's military government demonstrated Friday against West African sanctions that have cut off the country from regional trade and finance. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, imposed the punishment this week after coup leaders postponed promised elections to restore civilian rule by 4 years. For VOA, Annie Reisenberg reports from the Malian capital, Bamako.
Mali's military government called for mass demonstrations against ECOWAS sanctions that were imposed after a special summit last Sunday in Accra. ECOWAS said it would further sanction Mali if elections weren't held on a previously agreed-upon date of February 2022. In December, leaders proposed a much longer transition with the next elections held in 2026. Because of the new sanctions, which included border closures and the blocking of shipments of goods, except for essentials such as food and medicine, Mali reciprocally closed its borders to ECOWAS neighbors as well. Much of the country has been out of the control of the state since Mali was plunged into conflict in 2012. Modibo Drame, a student at the University of Bamako who helped organize the demonstration, says that he supports the current military leaders for a period of 5 years, or even 10, because he thinks that is the only way Mali will finally see security. We want our country to have stability, he says. If ECOWAS wants to, we can do this together. If they don't, we accept that, and we don't stay together. In addition to Bamako, demonstrators gathered in major Malian cities like Gao and Timbuktu, and in smaller towns across the country. The streets around Bamako's Independence Monument were blocked to traffic as thousands of people gathered by 3 p.m. Demonstrators could be seen carrying Malian and Russian flags. 60-year-old Abdurrahman Fofana, a pharmacist, came to the demonstration to support the military leaders, who he says are the first in Mali's history to be able to stand up against France.
Donc nous Maliens, qu'est-ce qui manque à nous, c'est de se donner la main.
He says, for us Malians, what's missing in us? That we are united. We have this today, thanks to the sanctions. We are united today. We will get through this. We are ready, even if it means death. Several political and religious organizations have issued statements denouncing the sanctions against Mali, including those that have rejected the transition's 2026 elections proposal. Etienne Fakaba-Sissoko, a political and economic analyst and director of Mali's Economic and Social Policy Analysis Research Center, echoed Fofana's assertion that the sanctions have united Malians politically.
On est Malien d'abord avant d'être politique, avant d'être.
We are Malians first, before being part of the opposition or part of the majority, he says. We know that the primary victims of these sanctions are not the authorities, but rather the population, who didn't ask to be in this situation. This is why we see these as sanctions against the population, more than sanctions against the country or against the current authorities. So this explains, in part, the support, the union, and the cohesion around the transitional leaders that we have today. Malian President Assimi Goïta said during a televised address on January 10th that he remains open to dialogue with ECOWAS to find a consensus. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Bye. semye koza bakola okula mu bunyuma bwobanga bakola sina bisera zinginda eyi ekinde se kwe kuhusabu oye ebigambo tebikula matatalina sente linda zitalifumita ebintu bya busene makeup ne bisiko bya busene yayo ebintu bya busene Banga febala foneka, abaga bala fonesembe. Mama na saba meleva, no muwa meleki na buka. Semi koso ya kolamu. Semi koso ya kolamu. Semi koso ya kolamu. Life we kuare money.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor William Eagle, Producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, giant silk cotton trees grow out of very tiny seeds. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.